Welcome to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Your host, Carl Nordgren, will teach you how to take an expansive view on what it means to be creative and entrepreneurial. Carl is an entrepreneur, novelist, and a lifelong student. For 20 years, he has been learning how to help folks grow their creative capacities. Now, here's Carl.
Yes, hello and welcome. This is Carl Nordgren. I'm so glad you've tuned into another episode of Exploring Your Creative Genius. I think it might be episode number 49. I'm going to check on that because if that means my next episode is number 50, I need to promise you all something special for episode number 50. So the show takes an expansive view of what it means to be creative. So I share with you prompts and suggestions and examples. Why? So that you can create your own understanding, the understanding that's going to work best for you of what it means to be creative, what it means to be entrepreneurial in your life, in your profession. Today, we're going to go about doing that with you, for you, with a series of stories, short little stories, and parables, some of which are factual. All are filled with wonderful, creative, human truths. Some of those truths just are shouting to us as we learn the story. Some are a little more subtle, and we have to sort of look for the truths. But boy, I love this series of stories and parables. And I'm going to start with one that speaks to sort of my place and time growing up. From about the age of 4 through my college years, I lived in Illinois, right in the middle of the farm belt, of the corn belt. And this is a story about a farmer and his corn. It was a farmer who raised the best corn. Boy, oh boy, year after year, his corn crop was so magnificent, so extraordinary, that year after year, he won the gold ribbon at the state fair, 10 years in a row. And that finally got the attention of a journalist. And so after winning the 10th blue ribbon in a row for his extraordinary corn, the journalist interviewed him and asked what his secret was. How is it that you grow such extraordinary corn year after year? And the farmer said, well, it's really quite simple. After I harvest the year's crop, I save some of my very best seed corn, and I give it to all of my neighbors, all the folks who grow their own corn around me. I give them my very best seed corn for their next year's crop. The journalist was a little perplexed. Why would you do that? Don't you compete with them, for instance, in the state fair competition for who's got the best corn? And the farmer said, yeah, I assure you that I do compete with them and that this is exactly what I should be doing, because don't you see that when corn begins to pollinate, the winds are blowing, there's breezes. And so the pollen from my field will blow into another farmer's field, and the pollen from his field will blow into my field. And so if I'm surrounded by farmers who aren't growing quality corn, eventually it's going to degrade the quality of my own. I assure that I'm going to have the wonderful, robust crop that I'm going to have by helping others plant the very best seed so that they can grow that same wonderful version, that same wonderful iteration of a corn crop. Isn't that wonderful? And that's one where the truth is right there, isn't it? It's apparent for us that we want to live in healthy environments for selfish reasons. We want to live in healthy environments, right? There's a pragmatic altruism there that when I do good for others, so very, very often that good is going to return to me. It's a commonwealth, right? It's a commonwealth that we could all extract from. There's this wonderful flourishing with others that comes through on this story. I love the story. Our second one is about a man who was walking through an elephant camp in Asia. And he noticed that the elephants weren't in cages. The elephants weren't chained. They were all secured with a rope around one of their hind legs, and the other end of that rope was just tied to a wooden stake. And that seemed just unlikely to this visitor that a rope like that could hold an elephant fast. And so he asked somebody, and they said, well, here's what happens. When they're very, very young, when they're newborn, we tie this rope around their leg, and stake them out just like you see them now. And at that point in time, it is strong enough to hold them, to secure them, to keep them in the place that we want our elephants to be. And as they grow, they never think to challenge it. They never think to challenge that which had been a barrier, that which had been a shackle when they were young. So that's a simple little story that reminds us that we want to examine as we change. We want to examine what's been holding us back, right? As we grow, as we mature, as we learn new things and get new experiences, let's make sure that we look over our shoulder and make sure that there's no early struggle, no early burden that is holding us back that we don't need to attend to any longer, that we can free ourselves from. I've got two egg stories for us, two separate stories that have eggs in them. And I think I can probably tell you one before the break, and we'll come back from the break with the other. This one is factual. Those first two were, I guess, were sort of fables, right? The farmer and his corn and the elephant and the rope. This one is factual, and it's back during the Depression. In the Depression, the Walgreens drugstore chain was already fairly well established by the time of the Depression. They were headquartered in Chicago, but by then they already had a number of stores throughout Florida. And so this is where this happened. During the Depression, of course, there were a lot of people suffering from malnutrition, from not consuming enough good, healthy food to keep them healthy. And so Walgreens decided they were going to do something about that, and they offered at a very, very low price a malted milk drink that was filled with nutrients and that would be a good healthy meal for them. Well, there during the Depression, they found a time where overproduction of eggs. There was no market for eggs in Florida, and so they were able to buy, you know, like 60,000 eggs for pennies. And their thought was, as we're offering this malted milk nutrition drink, maybe we can convince people that they should put an egg in their drink and get that additional protein, that additional nutrition. So the soda fountains at all these Walgreens stores where they were selling the malted milk, the soda jerks, usually an early 20s teenage person, boy working behind the fountain in those days, was instructed when a customer came in to say, would you like an egg in that malted milk? And you know what? They weren't selling any eggs. They weren't selling any eggs except out of one store. They discovered, and of course information would have moved much more slowly in those days, they discovered that there was one store that was having some success selling eggs. And so management went to find out what they were doing that was making them so successful. And they saw that there, the soda jerk had figured out that instead of saying, would you like an egg in your malted milk, he was asking the customer, would you like one egg or would you like two eggs in your malted milk? And people were buying eggs. And often, I think I read that as many people that were saying no to an egg when that was an option that was offered, that same percentage were in fact buying two eggs. So we'll talk a little bit more about this when we come back from the break, and we'll have another egg story for you.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. At the end of the previous segment, I shared the story about the Walgreens soda jerk, the soda fountain attendant, who realized if his charge was to get a consumer to buy eggs to include in their malted milk for additional nutrition, that instead of offering the choice of no eggs or one, he realized that he'd be more successful if he offered one egg or two and sold a whole lot of eggs. And of course, they therefore shared that with the other stores and sold their 60,000 eggs when they were starting to be concerned about that purchase. So here we have, what? Is this consumer manipulation? right? So maybe there's a negative side to this if consumer manipulation happens by in a situation where it's all about consumer manipulation and that's the goal. But boy, a lot of us are selling ideas, right? A lot of us are trying to convince others to get excited about that which we are excited about. So here's a story that maybe can help you think about how you get them to buy into that which you are offering, right? By giving them the appropriate, proper choice. Another egg story. This one I thought was true, and I've learned fairly recently that no, this is one of those classic apocryphal stories that you want to be true. It captures such a wonderful lesson. And it's back in Florence. They had built their cathedral, and decades went by, and the cathedral didn't have a dome. They weren't able to figure out the right way to construct the dome. It was going to be the largest dome at the time. This is in the 1300s, I believe. And so good old Brunelleschi, Filippo Brunelleschi, who was already a well-known architect and designer and artist, he was a contestant in the contest that the city fathers had about who are they going to choose, what architect are they going to choose to design the dome to finish off this great grand cathedral. And so the story that I thought was true until fairly recently was that Brunelleschi walks in, imagine a table with a whole bunch of men on a long, long, long table, and I'm seeing Brunelleschi sitting at one end of it, and he's got his leather satchel. Inside his leather satchel, he's got his architectural plans for how he's going to complete the dome. But before he takes those out of his leather satchel, he takes out an egg. He takes out a regular egg. And he says to everybody around the table, can any of you balance this egg on its end? And he actually passes the egg, as the story that I knew. He passed the egg to the individuals. And of course, they could not balance the egg on one of its ends, either of its ends. And so Brunelleschi gets his egg back, and he takes the egg, and he says, I can balance it on one end. And with, I'm used to say, a perfect practiced precision, hits the egg, the narrow point of the egg, he pops that against the table and breaks just enough shell that he can then push the egg to the table, let it go, and it balances on that little foundation that that broken shell has created. And he says to everybody around the table, look, see, I can balance an egg on one end. And apparently the people around the table said, oh, well, if I knew that that's how you could solve that, we could have done that. I could have done that if that's the solution. And Brunelleschi says, that's exactly my point, folks, that when I show you my plans for how to complete that dome, it's such a wonderfully, simply obvious solution that you all haven't seen for decades and decades that you're going to say to me, once you see my solution, oh, we could have done that. Oh, we can see how that, but you didn't see it until I showed it to you. How's that? How's that? This next story, again, a factual story. We have the letters. Good old Ben Franklin was contacted by a favorite nephew who was confused about his marriage choices. There were two women that he thought would make wonderful wives, and he was just conflicted betwixt and between as to which one he should choose. And again, we have this in Ben Franklin's letters. He wrote back to his nephew. He said, nephew, here's what you need to do. Let's say that one of these folks is named Jane and the other is named Donna. Don't those seem like decent revolutionary time names for women in those days? So put write each of their names, right? Jane on top of a page, Donna on the top of the same page, draw a line in between them, and down the left margin, write all the different categories of choice, right? Appearance, family, good cook, personality, all the things upon which one would might make a decision as to who they should marry, writes Ben. And then underneath each person's name, give them a score. Right? Jane is a 7 as a cook, and Donna is a 10. Give them a score. Jane's appearance is a 3 and Donna's is a 5. And take some time, Ben urges. You know, maybe do it a second and a third day. He uses the word calculus. Create a calculus for your choice, right? That's a rational – this is a very rational process to make your choice. He's taking his nephew through a very rational, careful, deliberate way to make that choice. He said, and so you've got these numbers for each one of these considerations. You've scored them all. Now, of course, what you want to do after going through this 2 or 3 days is you want to add up the scores. And so his nephew does. And let's say that Donna's score was a 17 and Jane's score was a 24. Well, the story is that the minute the nephew saw that Jane had the higher score than Donna, he realized he loved Donna the most because he was disappointed in this outcome. He was disappointed in this outcome. He had used his and prompted his conscious mind, right? His rational mind gave real careful consideration to this issue before them, him. And at the conclusion of that careful consideration, he then felt his subconscious mind at work. And his subconscious mind was letting him know through the sensation of disappointment, you've made the wrong choice. And he asked Donna to marry him instead. We got a break here now, folks. Look, got some more stories for you when you come on back.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. We've been spending this part of the morning together with me sharing stories with you, stories that share creative and insights. We talked about the farmer and his corn he grew amazing corn and he would share his great seed with his neighboring farmers so that they could grow great corn too because the cross-pollination would keep his crop doing well, so we're flourishing with others, creating commonwealth. The elephant and the rope, a big old mature elephant that gets held back by a insignificant rope because as a youth, that rope had that effect on the elephant and it hasn't reexamined the significance of that rope, the strength of that rope in its life as it aged. I've told you a couple of egg stories, one factual about how the Walgreens soda jerk would offer one egg or two, and people would choose an egg rather than other soda jerks offering, hey, do you want an egg? And then Brunelleschi's egg, where he balanced it through some trickery on the tip of itself. And we closed with Ben Franklin's nephew making his marriage choices and finally relying on his intuitive subconscious after he primed it with his rational mind. We got one or two more stories left for you. Here's one on the importance of perspective, right? On how you see the world, the 4P professions, philosophers and poets, but also psychologists and physicists, they all agree from their very different perspectives that we don't see the world the way it is. We see the world the way we are. Here's a great story about that. A pilgrim back in the days when cathedrals were being built throughout Europe. Maybe this is the 1300s. A pilgrim decides to go in search of wisdom. And so he hits the road and he comes across a town where it's clear above the trees you can start to see a new cathedral being built and it's rising and it's rising and this cathedral is. And then the town has been changed, of course, to house and feed more work people because this cathedral, the building of this cathedral, has attracted people from all around. And so there's all this hustle and bustle in the town as the pilgrim approaches the scene. And as he approaches the scene, he sees a series of stone cutters shaping the bricks, the stones that are going to go into the cathedral walls. And he watches them for a minute. This is a whole new activity for him to see a single individual at a work spot, hammer and chisel, shaping this stone block to become a brick in the wall of the cathedral. And finally, after watching for a while, he goes up to the first one, who he's noticed, this first stonecutter, is somebody who seems to be sort of lackadaisical with where he puts his chisel and how he hits it with his hammer. And he seems to be ready to be distracted by what is going on around him. He's always looking up about what's going on around him. Barely present to the work that he's doing is what the pilgrim thinks that he sees. But still he's curious. And so he goes up to this first stonecutter to learn what he can learn. And he says to the stonecutter, "So what is it that you're doing?" And the stonecutter says, "Oh, I'm cutting stone." The pilgrim says, "Okay, great." He noticed that the second workstation, there was a stonecutter who was much more careful with the way he put the chisel, the bit of the chisel, and how he hit it. Each strike seemed to be much more efficient than the previous. And he was committed to the work. He was working, and he didn't get distracted as the first stonecutter did, right? He was very efficient and very effective at his job. And so the pilgrim went up to this stonecutter, the second stonecutter, and said, "Can I ask you, what is it that you're doing?" And the stonecutter said, "Well, I'm feeding my family." Pilgrim absorbed that and then had noticed that a third stonecutter was not only as efficient, as effective as that second stonecutter was, but he did look around as like the first one did, but not out of a sense of distraction, rather out of a sense of, oh, over at that workstation, I can probably help that stonecutter out if I hustle over there and move the brick for him or hold it in place. And then he'd hustle back to his station and continue to do his work. And he had a song in his heart and he a spring in his step. And he just was bringing a whole nother attitude to this work that he was doing. Still highly efficient, still highly effective, but also trying to share what he could do by helping others. And so the pilgrim watches and admires and really admires and finally says, "Okay, let's see what's going on here." And so he walks up to the third stonecutter and says, "Excuse me, I hate to interrupt you, but can you tell me what is it that you're doing?" And you know the answer, right? You all know, don't you, folks who are listening? His answer was, "I'm building a cathedral." And folks, I was so fortunate. One of my most successful businesses was here in Chapel Hill, a company called FGI. And we were able to tap into wonderful Chapel Hill talent and recruit folks who were so excited about building a cathedral with us, because that's how we saw what we were doing. We were trying to create something really special. I hope all the things that you're trying to create that are really special are as successful as you want them to be, that the most that you desire for them or the least that you get from these wonderful projects. And thank you for listening. Show number 50 next week. Come on back. Hope you have a great week.
This has been Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. You can listen to other episodes on chapelboro.com.